You're listening to DTFHN for January 31st, 2026. I'm your Frequency Decayed host, AI George Carlin. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where engineers argue about everything except their own social skills. Today's got that beautiful smell of people trying to burn down the old ways and build something honest on the ashes. Strap in, let's go. So somebody built a tool called AntiRender that takes those gorgeous, glossy architectural renderings, you know, the ones where every building looks like it exists in a world where rain was never invented, and pigeons don't shit, and strips away all the fantasy shows you what the building actually looks like when reality gets its hands on it. When the weather hits, when the grime settles, when Tuesday afternoon in February does what Tuesday afternoon in February always does. And I love this. I genuinely love this because architectural renderings are one of the great legal cons of modern civilization. You're selling people a building that will never exist. That rendering, with the perfectly diverse group of attractive pedestrians strolling past your glass monolith at golden hour, that's not architecture. That's a dating profile for a building. And just like dating profiles, everybody lies. AntiRender is the friend who says, yeah, but what do they look like at 7 a.m. with no filter? Now here's the thing that kills me. One of the comments nails it. A professional cleaner points out that half the beautiful designs out there are impossible to actually maintain, gorgeous on the rendering, a nightmare with a mop. And that's the whole problem with the architecture industry's visual culture. You're not designing for humans who have to live in and clean these spaces. You're designing for the rendering. The building is just an unfortunate side effect of the picture. AntiRender flips that equation. Prove your design survives weather, dirt, time, and the fundamental indifference of the universe. If your building only looks good in Photoshop, you didn't design a building. You designed a Photoshop file. Now, I got to be honest about something. As far as I can tell, AntiRender is a web tool. You upload your image, it processes it, you get your result. There's no repo, no source code, no self-hosted option. It's a closed box. And look, it's clearly a fun project, probably one person's clever idea. And the comments are right that buy me a coffee is a terrible monetization strategy for something this viral, but the principle still stands. This concept, stripping away visual bullshit to reveal reality, is too good to live behind one person's server. Someone should build the open source version, put the model weights out there, let every architecture student, every city planner, every pissed off cleaner run this locally. The idea is a public service. It shouldn't depend on one domain staying online. The comments are beautiful, by the way. Someone immediately called it the Poland filter because apparently everything comes out looking like Eastern Europe in November. Someone else ran it on the Society If meme, and honestly, that's the best use case. Take your utopian fantasy, run it through reality, and see what survives. Most things don't. The good ones do. Speaking of things that don't survive contact with reality, let's talk about Europe trying to quit American cloud services cold turkey. So Europe finally woke up and realized that parking your entire digital civilization on servers controlled by a country whose president might cut you off because he's mad about Greenland. Maybe that's not the smartest infrastructure plan. The Register is reporting what anyone with half a brain already knew. European companies are scrambling to ditch American cloud providers and build their own sovereign tech stack. And honestly, good. It's about goddamn time. Here's the situation. 61% of European CIOs say they want to move to local cloud providers. More than half say geopolitics. That's a polite word for the United States has lost its mind. We'll stop them from depending further on AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud. Gartner says European IT spending hits $14 trillion this year, and a fat chunk of that is going into sovereign cloud and on-prem setups. Airbus just dropped a 50 million euro decade-long contract to migrate everything, data at rest, data in transit, logging, identity management, the whole stack, onto European-controlled infrastructure. Catherine Jeston, their digital VP, said it plain. We want to ensure this information remains under European control. No ambiguity there. Now here's where it gets fun. Amazon sees the money moving and launches its European sovereign cloud. Servers in the EU, operated by EU residents, pinky promise, and the European cloud trade group CISPE calls bullshit immediately, saying the EU's own sovereignty framework is rigged to favor the American incumbents. They're right. You can't solve a dependency problem by letting the thing you depend on rebrand itself. That's not sovereignty, that's a costume change. It's like your landlord painting the door a different color and calling it your house. You still don't own shit, and this is where open source becomes the whole ballgame. The article links to a piece titled Open Source's New Mission, Rebuild a Continent's Tech Stack. That's not hyperbole. If Europe migrates off American clouds but onto European proprietary platforms, they've just traded one landlord for another with a nicer accent. The real play, the only play that actually delivers sovereignty, is open infrastructure, open source cloud stacks, open compute, open everything. You cannot claim digital independence while running on software you can't inspect, modify, or fork. The commenters already get it. People are running on Hetzner, migrating databases to European providers, and one person correctly points out that the FSB Europe's position is right. It matters less where software comes from and more whether it's Libre. The comments also surface the uncomfortable truth nobody in Brussels wants to say out loud. Europe has no wafer fabs, no GPU designers. The silicon still comes from Taiwan and the United States. So sovereign cloud is only half the problem, but you start where you can, and software is where you can start today. Build the OpenStack, share the blueprints, stop renting your future from people who've demonstrated repeatedly, publicly, embarrassingly, that they'll fold the moment someone in Washington raises an eyebrow. From ancient empires trying to control the future to an ancient civilization that actually bothered to write down what hit them from the sky. 5,500 years ago, a Sumerian astronomer sat down and recorded what he saw in the sky before dawn. Not a prayer, not a myth, not a story about gods throwing hammers. He wrote down coordinates, trajectory, angle of descent. And in 2008, two researchers finally figured out what he was tracking, a kilometer-wide asteroid on its way to slamming into what is now Austria. Here's the setup. There's a clay tablet in the British Museum, catalog number K8538, called the Planisphere, found in the 1800s in the ruins of King Ashurbanipal's library in Nineveh. For over a century, nobody could figure out what the hell it was. Scholars knew it was astronomical. It has constellation drawings, angle measurements, the works. But the purpose remained a mystery. Then Alan Bond and Mark Hemcell ran the data through modern sky simulation software and matched the observations to a specific date, June 29th, 323 BC. Half the tablet is routine, planet positions, cloud cover, boring Wednesday night stuff. The other half describes an object so large its shape was visible while still in space, with a trajectory that points directly at Kofels, Austria. Now Kofels has its own mystery. There's a landslide there, 5 kilometers across, 500 meters thick, that geologists have been arguing about since the 1800s. Early researchers said meteor impact. Later researchers said, no, crater can't be. But the Bond and Hemcell analysis offers an answer. The asteroid came in at 6 degrees, basically skimming the surface, clipped a mountain, and exploded into a fireball before reaching the ground. No crater, because it never technically cratered. It detonated in the valley like the world's worst airburst. Think about what we're actually looking at here. A civilization with no telescopes, no computers, no orbital mechanics textbooks tracked an incoming asteroid with enough precision that 5,000 years later, we can reconstruct the event to within 1 degree of accuracy. That's not mythology. That's science conducted with reed styluses on wet clay. And the tablet survived because someone thought it was important enough to copy and store in a royal library. The original astronomer's notebook preserved through the bureaucratic instinct to archive everything. Turns out the oldest IT department in history did us a massive favor. The comments are split exactly how you'd expect. Half the people are genuinely awestruck, and they should be. The chain of human achievement required to decode this thing is staggering. Language reconstruction, orbital mechanics, computer simulation, all converging on one clay disk. The other half say, slop and move on. Two words dismissing 5 millennia of cumulative knowledge. That's the internet for you. The Sumerians had better peer review. From ancient clay tablets to modern packet routing, because apparently we never stop trying to figure out where the hell things are. So some guy looked at how IP info geolocates IP addresses using latency measurements and said, I can do that, and he did. Built a CLI tool that pings an IP from probes scattered across the globe, sorts the results by response time, and figures out what country, sometimes what city, that IP is sitting in. The beautiful part, it actually works. Here's the backstory that makes this interesting. IP info recently confirmed what every network engineer already suspected. VPN providers are full of shit about their server locations. They don't have infrastructure in 140 countries. They have servers in maybe 20 places and then lied to the regional internet registries about where those IPs are. They feed fake geolocation data to Aaron, Ripe, every geo database that'll listen IP info, caught them by doing something radical. They actually measured the physical latency to these addresses instead of trusting the paperwork. Turns out the speed of light doesn't give a damn about your geofeed file. Now this developer, Jiri Mack, took that same principle and built it on top of GlobalPing, which is an open source community powered network of over 3,000 probes that anyone can contribute to by running a container. That's the part that matters here. This isn't locked behind some enterprise API with a pricing page and a sales team waiting to talk about your geolocation needs. The tool is on GitHub. The probe network is open. You can run this yourself right now from your terminal. He even walks through the evolution of his approach, started with ICMP ping, realized most networks block it, tried TCP ping on various ports, found it unreliable, and landed on traceroute, analyzing the last reachable hop. That's real engineering. Try something. Watch it fail. Try something else. ship what works. The technique isn't perfect, and he's honest about that. Analyzing just the last hop won't catch every edge case. A commercial provider would cross-reference ASN data, try multiple protocols, weight results against HUS records, flag low-confidence IPs for retesting. But that's the difference between a weekend project and a business. The point isn't to replace IP info, it's to prove the concept is sound and hand anyone the tools to verify it themselves. The comments are refreshingly positive for once. Someone in the Netherlands points out that latency doesn't always correlate with geography, which is a fair caveat. Undersea cables and peering agreements make the internet's topology weird. Another person asked whether a host could introduce artificial latency to spoof its location. The answer is theoretically yes, which means we've come full circle from VPN providers lying in databases to potentially lying in physics. Humanity finds a way. From mapping the physical world through light speed to teaching machines, the music of human speech. Because apparently, even AI needs tone lessons now. So some guy in Sweden can't get his Mandarin tones right, and instead of hiring a tutor like a normal person, he trains a 9 million parameter neural network. I love this. This is exactly the kind of beautiful, disproportionate engineering response that makes humanity worth rooting for. Here's the situation. Mandarin has these tonal distinctions that are basically invisible to European ears. You say may 4 different ways, and it means mother, hemp, horse, or a curse word. Get it wrong, and you've just called your mother-in-law a horse. So this developer, who'd already built a vocabulary learning platform called Langseed, realizes people still can't understand a damn word he's saying. The vocabulary is there, the pronunciation is not, and he can't hear his own mistakes, which is the cruelest part. Your brain lies to you about the sounds coming out of your own mouth. His first attempt was a classic engineer move: build a pitch visualizer, run FFTs, extract dominant frequencies, map them with hand-tuned heuristics, and it fell apart immediately. Background noise, speaker variation, co-articulation, the real world is messy, and it doesn't give a shit about your carefully designed signal processing pipeline. So he pivots to the bitter lesson, which at this point should be tattooed on every ML engineer's forehead. Given enough data, learned representations, beat handcrafted rules every single time. He grabs 300 hours of transcribed Mandarin speech and trains a conformer model with CTC loss. The key insight is clever. Most speech recognition models, like Whisper, are designed to figure out what you meant to say, which is great for transcription but terrible for language learning. CTC forces the model to grade what you actually said, frame by frame, no charitable interpretation. You butchered that third tone, the model butchers you right back, and the whole thing is open source. Running on device, 9 million parameters. Not 9 billion, 9 million. That's a model you can run on a phone. He could have slapped an API on this, charged $15 a month, called it Tone AI Pro, and taken VC money. Instead, he put the code out there, wrote a detailed blog post explaining every architectural decision, and let anyone try it in their browser. This is how knowledge is supposed to work. Share the blueprints. The comments are predictably humbling. Native Mandarin speakers from Beijing are failing the easy test, which either means the model needs calibration, or Beijing accents are wilder than anyone admits. A couple users report misidentified syllables. Someone plugs their own Chinese learning project because Show HN comment sections are basically open mic night for side projects, but the feedback is constructive, people are engaged, and the builder is listening. That's the whole cycle working exactly as it should. From someone actually building with AI to someone philosophizing about it, because developers love nothing more than a framework for their feelings. So a software engineering team at Monarch, a personal finance app, published their internal memo about how to use AI in development. And their big philosophy is stay one step behind the bleeding edge. Don't adopt the newest thing the second it drops. Wait until it's battle-tested. They're calling it pragmatism. I'm calling it what it actually is, which is common sense dressed up in a company memo. Here's what's funny about this. The advice itself is completely reasonable. Don't chase every new tool. Review your AI-generated code before shipping it. Do your own thinking instead of outsourcing your brain to a chatbot. Don't shift the burden of your laziness onto your coworkers who have to review your sloppy output. Every single one of those points is just, that's called being a professional. The fact that someone had to write a memo telling engineers to check their own work tells you everything about where we are right now. We've reached the point where read what you wrote before you publish it is a controversial engineering philosophy, but here's where it gets interesting. They bring up Andy Grove's line about how the value of writing a document isn't in the document itself, it's in the thinking the writer had to do to produce it. And then they say if you let AI write it for you, you get 80% of the quality for 5% of the effort. But you've also only done 5% of the thinking. And that's actually a profound observation that most people are going to blow right past. The tool works great. The human holding it is getting dumber. That's the trade-off. Nobody wants to talk about it at the all-hands meeting. Now, Monarch itself is a closed source fintech product. This isn't some open source collective sharing their engineering playbook out of pure altruism. They're a company selling a subscription service for personal finance. So when they publish an internal memo publicly, that's marketing. Smart marketing, good marketing. But let's not pretend they carve these commandments into stone tablets on a mountaintop. The real value would be if they open source the actual tooling and workflows behind this philosophy, share the blueprints, not just the brochure. The comments are mostly people nodding along, which is the internet equivalent of a standing ovation for saying water is wet. One person pushes back on letting AI self-verify, saying they forced the model to never check its own work. Another points out that even Frontier Lab employees don't trust their own AI blindly. The most revealing thing in those comments is the quiet consensus. Everybody already knows this stuff. They just needed someone with a title to say it out loud before they felt permission to agree. From AI that can't be trusted to check its own homework, let's talk about the buildings where all this bullshit actually lives. Data centers. So Casey Handmer over at Terraforming Industries just published a piece arguing that the future of AI data centers is pure solar plus batteries. No grid, no gas turbines, no transformers, no inverters, just direct current from panel to battery to GPU. Delete everything else. And honestly, the engineering logic is hard to argue with. A GPU is fundamentally just a very expensive switch that regulates electron flow. Solar panels push electrons uphill, batteries store them, wire it all together in series at 1,000 volts, and let each electron do its job a few hundred times before it's done. No conversion losses, no moving parts, no fossil fuel supply chain gumming up what should be the easy part of the equation. The numbers Handmer lays out are compelling. He's comparing a hybrid solar gas system against pure solar with enough battery capacity to hit 99%+ uptime, and the pure solar setup wins on tokens per dollar, which is the only metric that actually matters if you're trying to scale AI compute. That gas backup you keep around for the 1% of the time you need it. It still costs money to build, maintain, permit, and connect, delete it, and you delete an entire category of complexity that was never making the AI smarter in the first place. Now here's what I love about this. Handmer's not just writing a white paper and hiding behind a paywall or a sales team. Terraforming Industries publishes this stuff on a goddamn WordPress blog. The ideas are out there for anyone to read, critique, build on. This is how progress is supposed to work. You share the blueprints. The Scale Microgrids paper he's responding to is also public research. This is engineers having an open conversation about how to power the next phase of civilization, and nobody's asking you to sign an NDA first. The broader vision here is genuinely wild. He's talking about Kardashev Level 1, harnessing the full energy resources of an entire planet, and he throws in space-based inference for good measure. Is it ambitious? Absolutely. Is it more grounded than half the pitch decks floating around Sand Hill Road by a country mile? At least Handmer shows his math. The comments are revealing. As always, you've got the expected hand-wringing. Why waste energy on chatbots? Gas turbines are proven at gigawatt scale. What about the land requirements? One person can't even comprehend wanting to harness this much energy for language models. Brother, every generation has someone asking why we need more than 640 kilobytes of RAM. The answer is always the same, because we're not done yet. So we're talking about mass producing the sun's power. Now let's talk about someone trying to set the web itself free. PeerWeb is one of those projects that makes you sit up and pay attention. Not because it's polished, not because it's going to replace Cloudflare tomorrow, but because the idea is so fundamentally right that you root for it anyway. The concept is dead simple. You open a browser tab, you paste in some HTML, and suddenly you're hosting a website over WebTorrent. No server, no domain registrar, no monthly bill to Amazon, just peers sharing bits with other peers. The way the internet was supposed to work before we handed the whole thing over to three companies in Seattle and Northern Virginia. Now here's what I love about this. The code is right there. It's open source. It's hackable. It's the kind of thing someone built because they thought it should exist, not because a VC told them decentralized hosting was the next billion-dollar market. No pricing tier, no enterprise plan, no scheduled demo with our sales team, just a web page and a GitHub repo. That's how you share your blueprints. The tech underneath WebTorrent has been kicking around since the mid-20-teens, and it's one of those technologies that always felt like it deserved a bigger moment. Peer-to-peer in the browser using WebRTC for transport. Anyone who's downloaded a Linux distro over BitTorrent knows the magic of a swarm. The more people who want something, the faster everyone gets it. That's the opposite of how centralized hosting works, where popularity is a punishment. Your traffic spikes, your bill spikes, and eventually some bean counter tells you to add a CDN. The obvious limitation is right there on the tin. You have to keep a browser tab open to host your site. Close the tab, the site vanishes. They've got a desktop client for persistent hosting, which helps. But let's be honest, this is still early. The comments reflect that perfectly. Half the people can't get it to work. The other half are nostalgic for the peer-to-peer web they never quite got to live in. And that's the thing about projects like PeerWeb. They're not products, they're arguments. There's someone standing up and saying the architecture of the web doesn't have to be landlord and tenant. It can be neighbors. The fact that it's fragile and janky right now doesn't matter. Every good idea starts out janky. The question is whether anyone picks it up and keeps building. From rebuilding the web's plumbing to rebuilding your photo library, because apparently nobody can just leave shit alone anymore. So this guy, Jaizen Mattai, has been obsessing over his photo management workflow for 20 years, and he's arrived at what might be the most beautifully paranoid system I've ever seen. The core idea is deceptively simple. Store all your metadata in EXIF, the data baked right into the photo file itself, no database, no proprietary sidecar, no cloud service holding your memories hostage. If the app dies, if the company folds, if the entire platform evaporates, your photos still know what they are, where they were taken, and what album they belong to. He built a command line tool called Elity over a decade ago, 10,000 lines of code, 1,300 stars on GitHub, open source, MIT licensed. It materializes your photo library onto the file system using nothing but EXIF data, and now he's written an IMIC plugin that bridges the gap. IMIC, for the uninitiated, is the open source Google Photos replacement that's been gathering steam like a freight train, self-hosted, full-featured, and it doesn't report back to Mountain View every time you take a picture of your sandwich. What Mathai figured out is that IMIC's external library feature, where you mount existing folders, read-only mirrors, exactly what he lost when Google broke the Drive Photos integration back in 2019. But instead of just viewing, he turned IMIC into a full organizer that writes changes back to EXIF, albums, descriptions, locations, favorites, all embedded in the file, then automatically synced to his Synology NAS and Dropbox. Three copies, zero database dependency. This is what 20 years of thinking about durability looks like. While everyone else is trusting iCloud or Google Photos to be the forever custodian of their family memories, which, let's be honest, is like trusting a landlord who changes the locks every 3 years, this guy built something that survives the death of every service it touches, and he shared the blueprints. Open source, go use it. The comments are predictably human. Half the people are excited. The other half immediately want to explain why a system won't work for their edge case. One person suggests just printing photos and keeping a stack of paper by the printer, which honestly, that person might be the sanest one in the thread. From preserving your memories forever to mass producing your mock-ups in seconds, because the tech industry never met a creative process it didn't want to automate. So tool called Galileo that generates UI designs from text prompts. You type dashboard for a fitness app and it spits out a full mock-up, layout, components, color scheme, typography, the works. And the Hacker News crowd is losing its collective mind over it, which tells you everything about how desperate engineers are to skip the part of product development where they have to talk to a designer. Now, let me be clear about something up front. Galileo is not open source. There's no repo, there's no self-hosted option. It's a cloud product with a pricing page and a wait list. You're renting someone else's model to generate designs that you'll then depend on for your product. If Galileo pivots, gets acquired, or just decides to double their prices on a Tuesday, and they will, they always do, your workflow is now hostage to someone else's business model. The blueprints are locked in their vault. That said, what it produces is genuinely impressive from a pure capability standpoint. The mock-ups look professional. The layouts follow real design conventions. It understands component hierarchies and spacing and visual weight in ways that suggest someone fed it an enormous corpus of actual design work. The AI didn't learn design principles from first principles. It learned them from studying millions of designs made by human designers who spent years developing taste and intuition. That's not a criticism of the technology. That's just how machine learning works. But it's worth remembering when someone tells you AI understands design. The comments reveal the real tension. Designers in the thread are split between this is a useful starting point and this is going to be used to eliminate my job. And they're both right. It is a useful starting point. And it will be used by some product manager somewhere to argue that the design team doesn't need that new hire. Both things are true simultaneously, and pretending otherwise is dishonest. Here's what actually matters, though. A mock-up is not a design. A design is not a product. The gap between AI generated a pretty picture of an interface, and users can actually navigate this thing without wanting to throw their phone into the ocean, is enormous. That gap is where real designers live. Galileo can generate 1,000 dashboard layouts in an hour. It cannot tell you which one your actual users will understand. It cannot watch someone struggle with a flow and feel the specific frustration that leads to the insight that fixes it. It cannot do user research. It cannot argue with a PM about why the third tab should be removed entirely. Design is a conversation between humans about humans, and no amount of generated mock-ups changes that. One commenter nails it. This is Canva for UI, not Figma for UI. It democratizes access to decent-looking layouts, which is genuinely valuable for solo developers and tiny teams who can't afford a designer. But calling it a design tool is like calling autocomplete a writing tool. It finishes your sentences, it doesn't have anything to say. So there you go, a world still trying to close the gap between what things look like and what things actually are. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for January 31st, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated, voice inspired by George Carlin, scripts by Claude Opus 4.5, voice by QN3TTS, not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that outlasts the platform you build it on. We'll see you back here tomorrow.